Right, we are on the record now. Again, I am Susan Drummond, the Kitsap County Hearing Examiner. Today is Thursday, April 26, 2018, and we are now on the final item on the agenda, the FSTAP Quarry Road appeal. I think we've got a few, couple procedural issues to deal with before we get into the substance of this. The first one was the motion to dismiss on SEPA. There was an early motion to dismiss for clarification by the Department of Community Development. That was joined in by the applicant, who also filed a motion to dismiss, and the applicant, or I'm sorry, the appellants opposed that. I then dismissed the SEPA part of it as finding I didn't have jurisdiction. There was then a motion for reconsideration. And there were responses filed on that. I think I have a pretty good understanding of the arguments on that. I'd like to very, very briefly hear just oral argument on kind of the SEPA piece, but just very brief. I think I have a pretty good sense on the issues. It did look to me like there was just one appeal that was filed, the FSTAP appeal, because there was one appeal form, I presume one appeal fee, and rather than two appeals, and that's what it looked like to me. So, but briefly, if we could address that, and I think then we'll move on to the clarification piece, and then we'll kick off the substantive piece of the hearing. So, on that, since would the appellants like to start on that, since you had filed the motion for reconsideration on the SEPA?
I think that makes sense, Madam Examiner.
If you could, actually, you know what, before we start, let's have everyone introduce themselves for the record, and then you could do that, yeah.
Okay, so my name is Alex Seidels. I'm a lawyer at Bricklin & Newman in Seattle. I represent the appellant, Chico Creek Task Force. Should we
give everyone at the table here? Just the person that's speaking, you certainly can introduce the others if you wish to.
Sure. I have Jack Stanfill of the Chico Creek Task Force here, and I also have our expert witness, Dr. Sarah Cook.
Okay, thank you.
And my name is Craig Jones. I'm with Pinnacle Real Estate Law Group. Mm-hmm. I represent the applicant, which is Yulin Tree Farm, and I have with me Mark Marin, who's the Chief Operating Officer for Yulin Tree Farm.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Lisa Nickel, Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office, and I have with me Jennifer Lawrence, who's one of the planners, reviewers for Stormwater, and Steve Peacock, another planner.
Thank you. All right, let's move very briefly to the SEPA jurisdictional piece of this.
Yes, thank you, Madam Examiner. We believe that we have actually raised a SEPA appeal. And just to be very clear, we are not appealing the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement of 2015. Instead, we are appealing the SEPA decision that was related to this SDAP permit. Because of the size of the road that's going in, DCD has acknowledged
that. What was the SEPA decision then?
So maybe some background would be helpful. When Yulin Tree Farms put in a application for a conditional use permit, which I believe was back in 2010, they had to do an environmental impact statement because it's a giant gravel quarry and basalt mine and so forth, a huge project. Originally, they were sending their trucks out of that quarry to the north. A few years into it, they decided to start using a southern route. Because the southern route had not appeared on the initial conditional use permit or been analyzed in the EIS, they submitted a supplemental EIS in 2015. Chico Creek did appeal the supplemental EIS unsuccessfully. So now there is, the next phase of the project, which is to actually start building the thing. This SDAP permit is for one segment of that southern haul route. They've been relying on the SEIS that was done for the revised conditional use permit when the southern route was initially proposed. But we say, and DCD has agreed with us, that even this SDAP, which is, basically a glorified grading permit, because of its size, is subject to SEPA. Now, the SEPA, to call it a determination, I think is wrong, but the SEPA decision in this case was, well, the SEIS already looked at all this stuff. The SDAP is just one small part of what the SEIS contemplated, so we'll just rely on the SEIS. And that's why I say we're not here to appeal the SEIS. That was in 2015. It's too late to appeal now. But we are appealing the SEPA decision that was made for this SDAP road, which decision was, we can just rely on the SEIS. Everything's already been thought of. There's no need for a threshold determination and so forth. So that's the heart of our appeal right there. In terms of being dismissed on the SEPA issues, it's true that when we filed our notice of appeal, there are check boxes on the top. You have to check one. I've actually got a copy here, which is probably helpful to project.
I do have a copy of that.
Oh, okay.
So.
All right. So if you look at it, it says appeal of, and then it says choose one, a project permit decision or a SEPA determination. Can't choose both. It says to choose one.
I would assume you would just have two forms, and then so one form for one appeal, then one form for another, and then you would have to pay two appeal fees, one for the SDAP and one for the if you have a determination or an EIS to appeal.
Right. We understand that's the county's position for what we should have done. But as you just mentioned, Madam Examiner, in the previous case, it's usual to appeal both the SEPA decision and the underlying decision, consolidated.
Correct.
Within a single appeal. That's what we've tried to do here. We think that the SDAP is wrong for violating the Kitsap County Land Use Code, and we think that it's wrong to rely on the SEIS to analyze the SDAP road's impact. We are appealing both. And I think if you read the documents that are referenced in the appeal notice, that comes across very strongly. There's not a failure to raise those issues. There's just a failure to check two check boxes or to pay two appeal fees. But I don't see that controls, whether or not we've raised the issues. I think we clearly have.
Okay, thank you. Then did the county wish to address?
Yes, I would. So it's more than just raising the issues of the SEPA appeal. They need to exhaust their remedies and follow the rules for appealing. And it's long been the DC practice, and the reason why there's only a check one box is because there are two separate appeals, two separate tracks for dealing with something. They need to pay two appeal fees because there's a whole separate process that goes along with it. It is consolidated, but it doesn't. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're one combined appeal. They are heard separately during the process. There's different decisions on them, even maybe combined in one document. So the fact that they didn't check a second box and didn't file a separate appeal means they didn't file an appeal of the SEPA. Another thing to point out is Chico Creek admits that what the SEPA decision that they're calling isn't an actual determination. And under our code, 2104290, E1, that's our appeal process, and subsection E is for SEPA, it says that the county only allows administrative appeals for final threshold determinations or final EISs. They admit this isn't a determination. It's just some other kind of appeal. We don't have an administrative appeal process for that. So no administrative appeal was available, and also no threshold determination was required. Under the WAC 197.11.230, threshold determination is not required when there has been a previous threshold determination, and except when new information has been presented. And we've already discussed that there's no new information here. The CUP was a land use decision for the South Hall route and all the different accessory uses that went along with that. This SDAP is for the actual construction. We're on the same project. The same issues have been raised back then, and they're raised now. So there is no need for a threshold determination. So they didn't appeal anything, and that shouldn't go forward.
Thank you. Did the applicant wish to add anything to that?
Thank you. Just add a little bit. The WAC 197.11.600.3 actually requires the agency to use the existing documents unchanged. And we had a initial FEIS administrative appeal followed by a dismissal of that appeal, a subsequent court case on that appeal through LUPA, a subsequent dismissal again. FEIS is long gone. The SEIS had a administrative denial of the appeal and had an administrative dismissal of the SEPA challenge based upon a stipulation of the parties, whereby the parties agreed that they would that the applicant would add a few more mitigation conditions. In exchange, the appellants agreed to dismiss the SEPA appeal. So the administrative opportunities are gone. The applicants maybe had 21 days to file a LUPA appeal after stipulating to dismissal, probably wouldn't have been very successful. The opportunity to appeal both of those documents is over. And throughout the testimony you'll hear today, you will hear, even though they say they're not appealing the SEIS or the FEIS, you will hear continual statements challenging the validity of the information in those two documents, particularly wetlands, streams, buffers, delineations, and ratings, classifications. And that it should be prohibited such that that does not come into the record without the need to have to object every time it comes up. Thank you.
I am going to stand by my original decision on SEPA. I don't think that I have jurisdiction because there was not a second SEPA, or there wasn't a second appeal, meaning there was not an appeal of either an EIS or a threshold determination, which is before me. And I do think that the question of new arguments, I think I don't see anything that could somehow, even assuming if an appeal was filed, that could overcome that. But you do have to have an appeal, I think, to begin with on the SEPA for me to have jurisdiction. And I will issue a revised order addressing the arguments which have come in since the original decision on that. And I'll deal with the timing of that, I think, towards the end of the hearing. Thank you all, by the way, for complying with all the deadlines. This process has been a little bit more squished, I think, than usual. So I know it's y'all have been under the gun on this.
Madam Chairman, it seems like the main objection to our SEPA appeal is that we failed to pay a second fee and failed to check the SEPA determination box. Those seem like pretty minor procedural matters, given that, you know, substantively we have raised the issue that this SDAP is not entitled to rely on the previous threshold determination or the previous EIS. Would you give us leave to file a new appeal, this time checking the box and paying the fee but making no other substantive changes?
I don't have, given the appeal time frame and all that, I wouldn't have jurisdiction to do that. And usually appeal fees are, it's a jurisdictional question, so it's not simply a minor. I mean, sometimes you can have a question of substantial compliance, and that's different. But if there's, if the appeal fee hasn't been paid, usually that's viewed as jurisdictional. And I don't, and it's not, there have been other arguments. I'm going to focus here on this question of whether in fact there is or is not an appeal. But I also, I didn't see that new issues were raised, even if you do have an appeal. So I don't, it seems to me that SEPA has been fairly exhaustively dealt with, you know, you have the EIS, but it was the supplemental EIS, of course, that was on the Southern Hall route. And there was a prior challenge on that in terms of its adequacy. And I didn't see any new issues that came around that. So I don't see myself as having jurisdiction.
Okay. Can you have your final order reflect the rationale that you just raised, just so it's all?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll we'll discuss in terms of that. But yeah, absolutely.
Okay. For clarification, mm-hmm. with regard to the remaining issues that you previously dismissed, the trails, the green zone, are those issues now not in this hearing?
That is correct. So my order stands in terms of the dismissal because they were all framed as SEPA issues. So what we're dealing with now is, I think it's clarified issue one in terms of how to proceed on that. And I have a couple questions on that in terms of the scope, which code provisions apply, and that sort of thing. And I kind of would like, might be helpful, I think, to address that up front before we get into the substance of this. DCD had filed a supplemental response and then a response on the framing of the issues. So I wanted to address that to be clear on exactly the scope of what is before me. So can we turn to we can turn to that then. So in terms of what is actually before me, I do have a question on the code sections which apply. DCD had cited there have been amendments to Title 12. And so the under the development agreement, according to DCD, it's the they have some 2010 provisions, actually, right, that apply. So I wanted to get clarification on which provisions I need to be looking at. And so if the party's going to address that.
I'll go ahead and address it because I think it's easily resolved. We agree that it should be the older provisions that apply. That's what the development agreement calls for. It vests them to the code at that time. So
so it's the code provisions that the DCD proposed.
Right. I mean, the citations are the same, but the text is slightly different. And I know one of the exhibits has the new text, so we'll be able to discuss that. It doesn't change our arguments. The changes to the text are pretty minor, and we feel, you know, the analysis was incomplete and erroneous under both sets of text.
Okay, and just a clarification on that, there was a reference, in 1210.070, there's a reference to 030. My understanding, that should be a reference to 040. Is that?
That's fine.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Did the planning department or applicant have anything on that, anything else on that particular issue?
We are vested in the 2010 code.
Okay, so it's the provision I just cited as provided by the planning department are the ones I should be looking at.
Yeah, and that's for the stormwater code. And okay. They didn't bring up any CAO code. That's a different version.
Yeah, so in my order, I'd stated to provide the provisions that are at issue. So those would be the three. I think that's it. I think that's all. So those are the provisions I'll be looking at. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. And there is a question, too, on the particular streams at issue, the particular wetlands at issue. That maybe that's a matter to address in the hearing. And I did print it out. Myself, you all may explain better, but I did print out I think it was the site plan approvals that kind of show where this particular segment is in relation to it. But I think, unless are there any argument or questions at this point on the wetlands or streams that are an issue, or should we just leave that to the substantive part of the hearing to address?
I think it might be easier if we do address and figure out which ones, so we're not spending time on other wetlands or streams that aren't really within the SDAP area.
Okay.
And I would like to add that these streams that we're talking about, every one of them has been evaluated in the FEIS and the SEIS, and they've been deemed, that evaluation has been deemed to be adequate. So why we're bringing those up under some kind of a guise of SLEPA is hard to understand.
Does the appellant have do you have clarification in terms of the exact?
Right. So as I understand the objection there, it's, you know, all this stuff is SEPA compliant. As you know, we disagree with that, but we're dismissed on SEPA. So this is no longer a SEPA hearing that we're in. However, this is a Kitsap County Code hearing, mm-hmm. and we think that, you know, mere compliance with SEPA, even if it had been done, is not necessarily compliance with the land use code. So we're here to discuss the code provisions.
And I agree there too. It's a separate issue.
Right.
I'm just meaning in terms of the wetlands and the streams that this, because it's not the full road that is being addressed, but just the first phase.
Right.
And so there are some water bodies that are close to it.
Right.
It's just a question of that may be affected by that road. Mm-hmm. But it's a question of which ones, because certainly not all of the wetlands and all of this, everything is.
Sure, right, yeah, not the entire quarry, it's
yeah.
giant. We're here to appeal a single road. But that's not to say that the impacts are limited to the footprint of the road, obviously, you know, water moves around. Well, I suppose if we all want to just get right into, you know, identifying wetlands and streams and so forth, I mean, we've got to do it anyway. We may as well do it now.
I think I'll hold on kind of ruling on this, the scope of it and what impacts it, because it seems like it could get into the substance of it, and I want to make sure you all do present on the particular, you know, the water bodies that are in fact you know, affected by this particular road segment. But certainly it's an issue to be cognizant of, just because I only have jurisdiction over the SDAP, and SEPA, of course, is a broader statute in terms of what gets dealt with, but with the SDAP, it's what this particular segment addresses. So, so I'll leave a little. There's some leeway there, and we'll deal with this as the hearing proceeds. So, all right. Any other procedural issues, clarifications at this point?
We'd like to request leave to file a stipulation of the parties regarding the admissibility of the experts in this
okay.
proceeding, and also would request leave of the court to adopt as relevant the exhibits that UTF has submitted in its disclosure of exhibit list as relevant documents to this hearing and admit them.
Okay. And those exhibits are the UTF 1 through 27, I believe. And some of those were filed previously, I think, with the on the motion.
Yes, they're all in the record.
Okay. And I think what you've just handed up is a is that stipulation for me?
Yes.
And these are the three experts. I think you had submitted resumes for the three. Oh, wait, let's see. This is. Okay. And so the parties are all in agreement on this. I see your signatures on here, so I assume that's correct. Yeah. So, yes, this is admitted. The stipulation is fine.
And would perhaps it be appropriate to, yes, I did submit the three resumes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a couple days after the deadline, but I'd move the hearing examiner to please allow admission of those three resumes in light of the stipulations.
Is there an objection from the party?
No, it's fine, Madam
okay. Examiner. All right, this is admitted. I guess I could give it an exhibit number if, I don't know if it's necessary, but. You want to just say UTF 28 that way?
And put all three in the same?
Yeah, three in the same. Okay. All right. Is that the last procedural item, or is there?
Well, I mean, maybe we can kind of shorten things here. I don't have an objection to the admissibility or authenticity or anything like that of any of the exhibits from DCD or from ULAND. I'm willing to just let them all into the record. Are you guys willing to let in our exhibits A1 through A10?
County doesn't have any objection.
No objection by the applicant.
Okay. So we'll just go ahead and admit all of the exhibits that all of the parties have submitted. So it's 1 through 10 that I have from the appellant's, the applicant's exhibits, which we've just addressed. And then I assume that includes DCDs as well, 1 through 14.
And I intended that to include the exhibits that were filed with the motions as well.
Okay,
all
so,
of you guys' exhibits.
All right, so everything that's even if, and I know there, I think there may be a couple that aren't listed that right. were filed with the motions.
Fine,
so all the exhibits submitted so far are admitted. Okay. So that's the last procedural item, and we can move to the substance now. Okay. All right. So in terms of approaching this, did you all want to have brief opening arguments on this before we start calling witnesses and so forth?
Sure.
Is that okay? Did you, the appellate, wish to start?
Sure.
As the...
we'll go briefly, and okay. it will be brief because, as I said, we kind of briefed the heart of our case earlier, which is that this SDAP merits independent consideration of its environmental impacts. Setting aside the SEIS and SEPA, the code itself requires that. Specifically, 070 says that we've got to have downstream analysis and off-site drainage analysis. 080 says that, we've got to have analysis of groundwater interception and infiltration and seepage, among other things. And 090 says that we've got to investigate the soils, for their stability and erodibility and so forth. It's my understanding that DCD and ULAND intend to rely on the SEIS and its various addenda and attachments to fulfill those requirements. But we believe that, not only are there factual errors in those documents, but also that those documents simply failed to consider many important impacts. Most of this will be discussed by our expert witness, Dr. Sarah Cook, who is one of, if not the foremost experts on soils and wetlands in the state of Washington. And the worst of the unexamined exhibits are the failure to, the worst of the unexamined issues are the failure to think about catastrophic failures due to high volume storm events, including back-to-back storm events. There's been no consideration of what will happen if this road gives way, or the likelihood that it will give way. And also what impacts this road will have on groundwater. In a nutshell, and without stealing Dr. Cook's thunder, we think that the road has a high probability of washing out, and also will impound the movement from the nearby wetlands, which are more extensive than the SEIS documentation would admit. So we've got problems with groundwater. We've got problems with sedimentation and washouts and so forth. So that's what we expect to put on in the course of our testimony.
Thank you.
So the county will, are you going to go to your exhibit for your witnesses, or do you want
we can go through the exhibits, I guess.
If either the applicant or DCD or both, if you all wish to present an opening statement, you may do so, but don't have to. We can go right into the presentation of the case, and there'll be an opportunity for closing as well. So
I didn't know if you wanted all of them, and then we do ours. Or
I think opening arguments from everybody up front just to get it would be best, and that frames the case for me in my head. So.
Okay. I would make just a very brief opening that we will have experts that will prepare and demonstrate that the downstream analysis was performed. It's performed by a licensed engineer, Contour Engineering, and Brett Allen will be the witness with regard to that matter, and he's one of the experts that have been certified. Groundwater in the soils will be evaluated by our expert, Brad Bickerstaff. He's also one of the certified experts, and he will provide and testify with regard to his report on both soils and groundwater. And there will be testimony with regard to why, on the downstream analysis, it wasn't required to go to the level of evaluation being requested by the appellant.
Thank you.
And to respond in opening, so the three code citations, the 070, 080, and 090, all talk about documents that need to be submitted. The county did not rely on the SEIS or any of the CEPA decisions in the past for those documents. New documents were submitted by licensed professionals. They were qualified under county code as being able to provide that information. The documents were of a detail required by code, and our planning staff will testify to that. Dr. Cook has never been on site, to my knowledge. Her letter admitted that, and so that's some of the qualifications to be able to write some of these documents that are required in code. And also, this is an existing road, so any of the impoundment issues are already there. What the SDAP was looking at was mitigation for what they're doing now. That will be the county's testimony.
Thank you. So would you all like to move to present your case and start with your witness testimony?
Yes, Madam Examiner. So how should we do this? We've only got just the one mic here. So should we she has electronic stuff too, you know.
Yes. What is the party's preference on this? Because I think that mic is working, correct? So you can certainly testify from there. It might be a little bit of a juggle, but you can also step up there and use that microphone.
I'll stay here on this one. I can trot over any paper exhibits that you need. And we've got some nice big printouts of the site plan, too, so we'll go ahead and hand those out to everybody.
Oh, okay.
No, it's already on.
Kind of all craning our necks.
Already. Thank you.
let's not step over that. I don't want anybody tripping. Yeah, if you just give documents to the clerk, Ms. Walston, she can hand it up. Oh,
I don't know, do you have two of those?
One for the record, and one for, if not, it's all right.
It's in the record already.
Oh, it is. Okay. Do you have an exhibit number on this?
It's one of the documents in Exhibit A1, but why don't we just call this A11? We'll just call it a new standalone exhibit.
And rotate. Let me, I'm going to swear the witness in and then you can proceed.
Okay. I'm sorry, everybody. I'm a Mac person. here we go. And then I need to rotate. Oh, I guess I have to rotate first. Left click. It, every time I do that, it disappears. There we go. And now we want to go to full page view. Yeah, sorry, everyone. This is very different on a Mac. There we go. Okay.
Dr. Cook, you ready? Okay. Can you state your name for the record?
Sarah Spear Cook.
And you swear to tell the truth today?
I do.
Thank you.
Madam Examiner, I thought we'd kind of do a direct examination sort of thing rather than just turn her loose. But I do expect her to kind of guide us. So, Dr. Cook, I know we've stipulated to qualifications, but I still think, you know, just because we're admitted as experts, you know, there's still the question of how much weight to attach to testimony. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, qualifications, and experience?
Yes. I have been working in the wetlands ecology, restoration, mitigation, analysis, impact, etc. for 35 years. I moved here before there was a wetland delineation manual and have worked with every one of the delineation manuals up to the most recent one that we adopted in the state. And I have been a wetlands consultant that entire time. I am the fellow of the International Society of Wetland Scientists, and I am the past president of the Pacific Northwest chapter of that society. Which is pretty much the catch-all for all wetlands scientists, hydrologists, soil scientists, ecologists, wildlife people. I teach classes at Portland State, the Evergreen State College, and the University of Washington on soil, wetland soils, general botany and taxonomy and plant ID and field ecology, mitigation design, and weed infestation. I sat on the Washington State Noxious Weed Board for 9 years and finished my tenure a year and a half ago, because there is a weed issue in this. I am trained to perform the surface erosion and mass wasting modules for forest practices, the same as the project proponent's expert witness. And let's see, soils.
Sarah, what was your involvement, if any, with drafting the various ecology manuals?
Oh, yes. So for the wetland delineation manual, I was a reviewer, and for the four different wetland rating protocols that have been issued since 1992. I was on the team that developed the first three, taught the third one for the Department of Ecology, and was a reviewer for the fourth. So I know the wetland rating protocol backwards and forwards, and also have field tested all four of them in the field for ecology.
Tell us, if you will, about your involvement with this particular case. And I don't just mean the SDAP, but I mean the various EISs and conditional use permits that kind of set the background for what we're here to do today.
I was involved in 2015 reviewing the original SEIS, and last summer was asked to review the SDAP and submitted comments then, and then updated those when more documents were added to the file in February, and then the last week when you required us to respond to different questions that you had, have been part of that response to looking at code and seeing how our comments fit in with existing code.
So have you reviewed all of the exhibits and filings in this case?
Pretty much, yes.
Would that include the, I'm just going to kind of pick a few here that from DCD and Euland, would that include the wetland and fish and habitat assessment?
Yes.
And would it include what they've styled as Attachment 8? This is the Contour Engineering Preliminary Drainage Report of August 2015?
Yes. In fact, the list of the submittals that I have reviewed is in our submittal, my comments from August 26th, revised March 15th, entitled Chico Creek Euland Tree Farm Quarry Expansion and Service Road Installation.
And are you talking about our Exhibit A1 there?
I believe that's correct, yes.
So you've reviewed all 35 of the documents?
Yes, I have.
All right. Well, have you conducted a site visit? And if not, why not?
No, I have not. And only because we were not given permission for me to do so.
Did you seek permission?
Yes, we did.
And that was affirmatively denied?
Back in 2015, yes.
All right. But even though you haven't personally visited this and therefore, you know, are not able to draft up your own rival report, are you nonetheless able to evaluate the sufficiency and accuracy of the DCD and Euland reports?
Obviously, there are limitations without going out, but there are certain things that I can review, yes. Those being the formal documentation submitted by the project proponent with respect to the wetland delineation report and the attached data sheets that are to go with that report. Also included in that would be the wetland rating forms. It is possible to review the scorings that the people who filled out the forms did and utilize aerial photographs to respond to quite a few of the questions. So I reviewed that and also reviewed the drainage reports, the geotech report, and the fish and wildlife habitat management plan, because a lot of that is a checklist of items that are required in those reports based on checklists that have been identified by the Department of Ecology and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as what should go in a wetland delineation report and what should go in a habitat management plan and mitigation plan. So looking for items that are required to be included whether or not they are included, and the sufficiency of the background that has been included in the reports are all things that I can review.
Well, I suppose we should just get kind of right into the merits then. Can you give us a broad overview of what you see are the problems with the analysis that's been done for this SDAP road?
It settles down to a couple of major items, and one is the scoring of the rating for the wetlands, and I can't comment on the boundaries because obviously I didn't go out. But the way that the ratings have been applied to the wetlands, I and going over the rating forms and performing the aerial photographic analysis, which was not included in the reports, I discovered some discrepancies and some omissions that would have changed the scores that I would have given these wetlands, again, using the same scoring that the folks did in the field and only updating those based on information from the aerial photograph interpretation and the soils maps, et cetera. And so the wetland ratings, I think, were underscored for a few of the wetlands, and consequently, the buffers that were applied on those wetlands with respect to road construction or any other proposed building, I feel were the buffers were underestimated, and so therefore the impacts would have been greater than identified. Then also we get to the road construction itself and the erodibility of the soils. Again, not having gone out, I am relying on the project proponent's background information, and really no on-the-ground soils mapping was performed. All that was submitted was the National Resource Conservation Service soils maps, which are pretty notoriously inaccurate. But the soils, different kinds of soils that have been mapped for this area, I am able to examine those, and with what we know about those soils, which have been documented for the last six, 7 decades, by staff from the National Resources Soil Conservation Service, I can then apply those soil criteria and characteristics to a project such as this. I also can add my experience with many, 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 many logging road projects and doing the forest practice modules for surface erosion and mass wasting, and just my experience with walking forest service roads, logging roads, mining roads, etc., and knowing what happens on the ground when you have topography like this and lots of wetlands and lots of streams. And so all of those things add together that I am able to review a project, again, certainly not in as depth as I would like, because on the ground you see so much more than you are able to garner from reports. But I am able to comment on things that I either see are inconsistencies between different expert reports and things that I can clearly see are missing from different resources, such as, you know, the difference between the National Wetlands Inventory, the county's wetland inventory, the wetlands mapping, and things like that. So I am able to do a review, okay. Yes.
Beyond the wetland rating and buffer issue, and beyond the soil erodibility issue, both of which I'd like to discuss in more detail later, are there any other problems that you see with the wetland or soil or groundwater analysis that's been done with this project?
We should also talk, I would also include water issues, because there is a proposal to change the drainage configuration between the mine itself and the further construction of the road. So the documentation for the road construction was examined surface water flows based on the current topography and not nearly as much on what the topography will be in the future. Additionally, there's groundwater flows that are occurring, and groundwater is always a huge unknown for us. I mean, of all the components of any project, especially as an ecologist, because I've got to look at multiple different issues. Groundwater is the one we have the least handle on. No one sunk groundwater wells along the entire footprint of the road or even upstream. So a lot of it is guesstimate work. And so I do worry, given the there is a large amount of water, both surface and groundwater, in this area. You can see that by the sheer number of and size of the wetlands and number of streams that are present and the topography. So I do think that understanding how water is flowing through the system is not really understood quite as well as it needs to. And especially given my background in looking at stormwater events and their impacts on wetlands, I was part of a 10-year multidisciplinary research program through the EPA, the USGS, King County, the EPA, and a few other agencies, where we looked at the total wetland ecosystem from the soils, the water quality, the wildlife, the vegetation, and the water quantity and quality. And I have a pretty good understanding because I worked on this disciplinary team. And I took care of the soils and the vegetation components, but we mapped all of these different criteria. And knowing what happens in these systems when you alter topography and drainage and groundwater and you compact areas and you build or excavate in other areas, I feel that component of this project is not very well known. And I do have severe concerns about erosion, especially given the type of soils that we're finding in this area.
So I'm kind of keeping track here in terms of topics, and please correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like the four kind of topic areas are wetland rating and buffers, soil erodibility, surface water flows, and groundwater flows.
Yeah, correct.
Are there any other categories of impacts that we need to worry about? We can talk about mitigation separately. I'm just asking.
Yeah, I include mitigation as part of the wetland issue.
That was going to be my next question. What are your opinions regarding mitigation for these topics? And I realize we haven't talked about the impacts themselves yet, but do you see any problems with mitigation?
I outline those in a lot of detail in the comments that I submitted from August 26th and revised in March of this year. The level of detail provided with the mitigation report is much more something that you would expect from what engineers would call a 30% design, which is pretty preliminary. We got a species list with no numbers. We got approximate impact acreage. We didn't get much else as to where the plants were going, how the density, et cetera. And so I had some detailed concerns about the information that was provided with the mitigation.
And I know one of our exhibits here is a sample mitigation. Can I put that up and have you walk us through?
Sure. Actually, I don't think I have it electronically.
Yeah, right. We have the ability to project paper copies of things here. So,
is that A10 that you're referring to?
Yes, that's right, Madam Examiner. Sample mitigation design. And we'll put it up on the big board here.
So this is a sample analysis that you would go through if you were going to do a mitigation plan, and it's basically what I also teach the students when I teach the mitigation class. And it's a systematic checklist with the analysis included of everything that you should consider. So you look at your lots, you calculate their acreage, you figure out what the potential impact's going to be, and then you identify impacts to impervious areas, impacts to pervious areas, permanent impacts, temporary impacts. You figure out the acreage, and then you look at impacts to buffer areas, impacts to wetland areas. If you're looking at a area that has wetlands and or streams, I would include in this too, especially the banks of the streams and their buffers, and calculate all the acreage. And most, the state has best available science designated replacement ratios for that, typically. And then each county has their own way that they deal with it, that the state ostensibly has reviewed and approved, though that has fallen through the cracks on some of the counties in the state. But for the most part, you know, if it's a buffer, for example, you have to replace the on-the-ground one-to-one for the required buffer width. And again, I would just mention that some of the buffer widths were based on ratings that I had an issue with, so I think some of the buffers were undersized. But anyway, for this is just going over the protocol. So you know how much acreage you have, and then you go to the actual design itself. You usually go out and you choose an area that's not been impacted. So we don't really have pristine habitats here, but you look at a habitat that you want to emulate. It's either part of your project or somewhere nearby. And you look at the different species that you find and come up with the vegetation communities, which is an assemblage of species that you know works in nature. You don't want to just choose them yourself because they don't necessarily work together. And then you take that acreage and you apply it. You apply it to typical landscape architect types of distributions of plants and concentration of plants. So big trees, you're going to not want them any closer than kind of 8 to 10 to 12 feet next to each other. That's called an on-center. There's a multiplier for that. And then you figure out how much cover you want in trees to emulate the community that you're doing. So I've got the example up here, and it's pretty straightforward. And then you use the architectural multiplier and the acreage, and you come up with a number of trees, a number of shrubs, and herbs if they're applicable. And then you plug that into the species that you've selected, hopefully based on some kind of percentage in the community that you've looked at in nature. And so you have particular numbers per species, per polygon where you're doing your mitigation. So you've identified on your site plan where you're going to do your mitigation. You've identified your species list, and you've come up with numbers for each of the individual species. And oftentimes you can do two things. You can either do a landscape plan where you're actually placing these individual plants as symbols on a paper so that a planting party could go out, follow that plant on the ground and put them approximately where you've placed them, or you could do something called an as-built, which is you designate a polygon. You've got the same number of plants, and either you as the ecologist who's designed it or somebody who knows what they're doing walks around and places the plants, and then the installation folks dig them in. So that's typically how we do this. And as I said, you know, in a mitigation, you'll have you could have buffer, you could have wetland, and if there's different kinds of habitats, they'd be designated as different, you know, different polygons, and you'd go through this systematically for each one of those. And I don't see any of this in the habitat plan that was submitted. It's very, you know, you basically, I got a species list. On the map, there is kind of polygons, but not designated downstream bank, upstream bank, you know, or left bank, right bank, stream corridors, no. So it's just basically a species list. So no identification as to whether or not it goes with any particular impacts from the road's edge. No discussion of details on what you're going to do for your temporary impacts, which is usually that area of the road shoulder that the cats might go over a little bit on where they know they're going to impact, but then they could, you know, cats are notoriously bad at staying within boundaries that you've designated on a piece of paper. So that was mostly my comment about the mitigation plan, is it lacks a lot of detail, but yet the SDAP was approved and that level of detail was approved. And as you'll see in my comments, I am a reviewer. Either I'm on staff for local jurisdictions, or I'm a third party reviewer, or I also do expert witness, which is what I'm doing now. So I wear lots of different hats in my life. And had this been submitted to me, I would have requested additional. I would have said, this is a great preliminary, but I need more information.
Dr. Cook, what's the problem with submitting a vague mitigation plan? I mean, what difference does it make?
It makes a difference in that there's the old boys network of, trust me, I'll do the right thing and when all is said and done. And I've been around this long enough to know that that doesn't work. And also, there is no licensing for what we do in the state of Washington. You can't get a license as a wetland ecologist. We've tried, but you can't do it. Also, the soil scientists, there's no licensing for that either. So any Tom, Dick, or Harry can hang their shingle up and go into business. And the level of competency, it varies drastically. So without requiring this up front where the county staff can review it, your trust us will do the right thing in the end can become a total nightmare when the project goes to get installed. And I unfortunately have seen this happen time and time and time again. So it's just not a good idea to leave these things to chance. You really do need to provide this level of detail. And you know what? I would also add that citizens groups or whoever appeals these things aren't necessarily always a bad thing, because if the tables were turned and I was the one who had submitted this plan, I personally feel that the more eyes that look at the work that I do, the better it gets. People catch things that I miss. I may miscalculate something. I may miss a polygon. I may have a different experience about how two plants get along in a system in an area that I haven't worked before, and one of the plants could be highly invasive in this particular county, and somebody could comment on that. And I didn't know it, but the more eyes that look at it, the better. And so, it's a good thing to have lots of people reviewing these.
And given the vagueness of the mitigation plan that was submitted, do you believe DCD has any means to verify compliance in any meaningful way?
No, not really.
If they had submitted a mitigation plan more in line with yours, with the polygons and the grids and so forth, would that make the mitigation plan more verifiable?
Yes, because if you say, I'm going to plant 17 big leaf maples, and you have performance criteria that are required as part of these mitigation plans, and so the performance criteria is you can't have more than 10% or 15% mortality, then somebody the next season can go out and count on the ground how many plants are still left, and say you're in compliance or you're not, and you can require replanting. So the county has very little recourse with the information that was provided to say you're not in compliance. wetlands. And again, that's why you need to provide more details in these kinds of plans.
Okay. Do you have anything else on mitigation? I don't have any more questions.
Yeah, I'd have to go through, but you have my submittal, so it goes over all of the things that I found in detail.
Okay. I mean, we kind of put the mitigation before the impact here, which I guess is a little weird, but let's go back to those impacts, the sort of four categories of impacts you talked about. And I think this is a good time to address DCD and Ulan's concern about, you know, where exactly are we talking about? So you've got the big scale map up there. Can you explain to those of us who haven't spent 3 years working with this project what we're looking at here on the map?
Do we have a laser?
This is the one you handed out earlier, right?
That's yeah. Right,
do we have a laser pointer? I can use it. Yeah, I can. I guess I can use the little hand. Okay. If you look, you've got the lake to the south, and the stream flows are heading this way. There's a culvert. Well, you know what? Can I do the next figure?
We can do either. What I was hoping for with this one is you can give us a kind of sense of the SDAP's place in the universe, and
Then
the next map shows the SDAP.
Okay, so yeah, so the SDAP is this beautiful little kind of sideways curving J. And so it's connecting this existing road system and this existing road system, and it will be enlarging the footprint of this. And so the next, and you know, notice all of these shaded areas are all wetlands. The dotted lines are streams, and there's streams that come in from the west. There's streams that come in from the south. There's streams that branch off all over the place. So there's quite a lot of stream systems. And then you've got a lot of tiny little wetlands that are likely hydrologically connected, if either through groundwater or shallow surface water at high volume storm event times of the year, but lots of wetlands in this area. So it's a pretty wet terrain, and there's a lot of topography which shows up a little bit better, but you can see the topo lines certainly in your figure, which is a little crisper.
Okay, let's go to the second map.
Then. Okay, so escape.
We can also project on paper if that's easy.
Okay, so I have to do this again. Sorry, everybody. Clockwise. Yep, there we go. Okay, and then we want full page.
So this is a more zoomed in version of the same SDAP road, is it not?
Yes. And so you can see the topography a little better. So pretty steep terrain in some of these areas. Again, I would mention, and I'll show a little later, some of the soils that have been mapped, although, again, we don't have on-the-ground mapping of the soils. But if for what we know that's present in the region, a lot of these are also erodible, which would make sense because you're going to have a gravel mine in an area that's a glacial terrain. So the soils are going to be gravelly, sandy, silty soils.
I'd like to kind of go issue by issue. So we'll certainly get to soils. But the number one issue I'd like to talk about is wetlands. Can you introduce us to the wetlands that we're looking at and the streams as well, both labeled and unlabeled?
Yes, hold on, because I can't really see the screen very well. So
do you want the paper?
The large wetland to the north is Wetland E, and it has a lobe on it that comes down and is it within a pretty close proximity of the road. One of the issues that there's a contesting between what I'm seeing on their plans and what the project proponents stating is present is the difference between the edge of the impact area for the road and that wetland lobe. And I scaled it and found it to be 22.5 feet, I believe. And they keep Every time I brought that issue up, the other side says it's 56 feet. So I don't have the scale off, so I'm not really sure why there's a discrepancy between, but the required buffer width is 50 or 55 feet.
May I interrupt you there real quick? If the wetland was rated differently, would that have any effect on the buffer size?
Oh, certainly, but they're already acknowledging that their impact, they're doing a 50% buffer reduction. So the buffer should have been 100 feet, and you can see, let me get my little hand pointer here. This little blurb is what is the required buffer, and if this wetland had been rated higher, the buffer would have been 200 feet, and so the buffer would have been even further. But, I mean, this is already in the area that is within the buffer. So, you know, you can't encroach more than you're encroaching. You're already encroaching.
Right.
It just would have encroached more area back down in this side. And actually, there is a section of the road that is not currently within buffer, but it would also have been included as impact had the buffers been, the rating been higher and the buffers been designated as larger.
Now, speaking of buffers and things of that nature, I don't know that we need to go, you know, quite wetland by wetland, but I see that there are many different wetlands, each separated by a certain, you know, amount of space, you know, like, I don't know, you took my paper map here, so I can't even read the screen one, but the way it's depicted on that map, it looks like not everything in there is a wetland. Is that right? At least as the map shows it?
That's correct.
So there's like boundaries between the wetlands.
And yes.
And the space in between, this map does not consider to be wetlands, does it?
It's not considered to be wetland.
Right.
And again, I wasn't allowed out, so
right.
I can't say.
So do you have any reason to be skeptical of the claim that these are distinct wetlands rather than, you know, some kind of conjoined body of wetlands?
I would certainly examine it if I were allowed to go out, because it seems, given that there's stream connectivity between these smaller wetlands and the large stream that comes in from the south, it does seem odd that at least during higher volume storm events that these all these little wetlands would be connected, but, you know, again, I can't comment, but it does, you know, there is always a chance that these smaller wetlands could be hydrologically connected.
During a time of high volume storm events, would you expect these wetlands to swell?
Yes, certainly.
And like during the summer or some other dry season, would you expect them to shrink?
Yes.
So wetland boundaries then are kind of fluid, right? They're not as definite as this map makes it.
Actually, no. There's a protocol that we're all required to comply with that looks at criteria that are pretty established. And having water present during the winter and higher volume storm events, it has to be reflected in the characteristics of the soil and the vegetation. But that doesn't mean that, you know, they're not connected. So I, you know, again, I just would have to look out on the ground.
But certainly, you would say, well, would you say it's likely that during a high volume storm event, there'd be a lot more water in that basin?
Oh, yes.
Than what's shown here.
Yes.
All right.
Which plays to the erodibility issue again.
Well, and I think it makes sense to talk about soils now. All right. So, granting, you know, kind of as a hypothetical that maybe these wetlands are bigger than what the map shows, what does that mean in terms of impacts caused by this road?
Well, that I would contend that they're potentially larger than has been designated.
Okay.
So, therefore, more mitigation should be offered at the very least.
Would larger wetlands pose any kind of risks to the road?
It would depend on their stability, their ability to store the amount of water that's in the system during a large volume storm event or a back-to-back storm event. If the wetlands are swelling to a huge extent and, you know, you're close enough to the road, you could certainly wash out the road.
And was there any analysis of back-to-back storm events or high-volume
storms? Not that I saw.
And yet, that would be a significant impact to the road if those events happened, it sounds like.
Yes.
What is the relevance of soil erodibility and soil surveys? Why bother to do that stuff?
Mostly because we have seen in Washington State, because we have such a large percentage of glacial terrain, that a lot of very erodible soils are present in areas where there's logging and mining. And it's really common for these roads to wash out. They wash out with great regularity. It's one of the reasons that the timber industry allowed themselves to be regulated under the Forest Practices Act, because they even had to acknowledge that there was a huge problem with roads washing out. And, you know, then obviously downstream receiving waters that were salmon bearing, getting massive loads of sediment in them and killing fish. And so that's why it's important to look at these issues. Two of the modules in the Forest Practices watershed analysis is to look at the soils and the erosion properties of slopes and things like that for this reason.
So it sounds like there's impacts both to the road itself and then potentially downstream as well during these washouts.
Yes.
And have you seen any analysis of those impacts in any of these materials?
I saw very little about downstream receiving waters.
What would you have wanted to see in terms of a good analysis of that?
Well, one, I would have liked, given it's a short stretch of road, it would have been fairly easy to map the soils along that stretch of the road. And I would have wanted to go both upstream a bit and downstream a bit, because you're going to be pinching the drainages that would have flowed naturally through forested area and vegetative structure. You're pinching them down into these little drainage courses that obviously the more you pinch, the faster the velocity is and the more volume there is in a smaller area. And so it would be pretty important to know what the soils are like in those areas. I saw no evidence in any of the reports of actual on-the-ground mapping of soils. They did, however, use the Soils Conservation Service maps, although they neglected to include one of the very important soils that's very highly erodible in their maps, that covers over half of the SDAP footprint.
Dr. Cook, are you talking about our Exhibit A5 soil survey? Let me give you a copy so you can.
Yes.
All right. So let me put that up on the board here for everyone. So what are we looking at?
Actually, if you don't mind, can I pull up the soils map that was in there?
You are literally the expert.
Okay. So sorry, get you nauseous flitching back and forth, but here, let's view this. Zoom, here we go, sorry. Oh, that's not helpful. Hold on, sorry. Why am I not finding this?
You want to zoom in?
Yeah, I just want to. Yeah, I just did that and it didn't.
Can you drag that?
Oh, there, okay, there we go. Yeah, it's really ridiculous that.
What's the exhibit number on that?
This is in the, I believe it's both in the Wildlife Habitat Management Plan, and there's also a discussion of the same soil units in both the contour and here, hold on.
Yeah. If it's the Habitat Management Plan, that's
Sorry. I was trying to do two things at once. There we go.
So let me get an exhibit number, otherwise it'll get confused.
We didn't.
So
we might have done that. Was that Jeremy's?
It would have been.
UTF 16?
I only have it if it's the wetland and fish and wildlife habitat plan. I saw that as attachment 8 to one of the motions to dismiss that they filed.
It says here on my index it was filed previously, so I don't have the index of the prior motions in front of me.
Which one do you guys have?
Not labeled on the computer, is it?
I'll have it for you.
Oh, okay.
And this is also in the Geo Resources May 2017 Geotechnical Engineering Report Addendum.
Oh, it's in the Geotech Addendum?
I don't know that the map is, but they discuss the soils that are found, that are mapped.
I don't think it's the exact document, but there is the soil map in the Geo Resources, which is DCD Exhibit 7.
Okay.
And it
may also be in UTF 16, which is the Wetland Fish and Wildlife Management Report.
Yeah, that's the one I said first.
Okay
so right. UTF 16 and DCD, is it 7? That says a May 17 date.
It's in DCD Exhibit 5.
Oh, Exhibit 5.
So to give you some bearings on the ground, this is the previous area, and then the project basically goes right across between this area right here. And so the soils that are mapped in this area, and the numbers correspond to specific, they call them soil series, there are types of soils that have been identified, that 40, the 10 over in the right hand side along the eastern edge of the project is called the District Xerothrin. And that, if you look at the soil survey of Kitsap County area, Washington, there are a series of, they both describe the soils in the area, and then there are a series of tables that classify the different characteristics of those soils for different things, like can you do it for forestry, can you run cattle on it, can you build a building on it, can you build a road on it, and so if you look into the tables,
Dr. Cook, just so we're all on the same page here, can you explain the relationship to the Exhibit A8, I think it was, and this manual full of tables that you've just hauled up now?
Yes, the exhibit is a map of the soils, and the manual.
This exhibit here.
This information is garnered from the tables in that manual.
I see. And what is that manual?
So it is the.
And again, we're not offering the manual as an exhibit, Madam Executive.
The Kitsap County Area, Washington Soil Survey.
Just to explain the method.
Yeah. So what I did.
It's the cover page.
Yeah, it's just the cover page.
Yeah.
So
what is that manual, and what is it? What does it teach us about the soils at this SDAP road?
So the manual examines the landforms in a particular county. It's done county by county, and it looks at the landforms, what came into the geology to make those landforms, and how the rocks erode to soils, and then what the soil characteristics are. And a lot of what makes a soil is where it's located with respect to water bodies, where it is with respect to mountaintops. So if there's different soils on the side slopes of a river valley than you'll find in the bottom of a river valley. There's different soils in the wetlands adjacent to a river than in the bottom gravels of that river. And this manual basically maps the soils for a particular county, figures out the different ones you find in the different parts of the landscape and what their characteristics are. And a lot of it is aimed towards engineering and farming, because that's what people tend to use soils for mostly. But these are the four soils, and actually there's a fifth one that that I discovered when I went back to look at the soils map in the wildlife habitat management plan that wasn't mentioned in the georesources report. And it's quite important. So instead of doing this, I added one extra category to that table, and I just discovered this last night, so you'll have to bear with me. Here we go. So I added the extras category, which is one more soil, the Ragnar fine sandy loam. And the reason that's important is we go back to the map. Sorry, I grabbed the wrong part. I think I do the left hand. I don't know the different buttons. Sorry, in the Mac we only have one. Here we go. Here we go. Okay. So if you look, and again, the little hand arrow, there's the part on the eastern part of the road, and it travels right where the little cursor's going right now.
Wait, where's your cursor? I can't.
Right there.
Okay.
Okay, so the road's going to cut right across through here. That's that diagonal. Can you see this 46, which takes up half of the road footprint? That is the Ragnar soils, and it wasn't mentioned in the geotech report. So that's a bit of a problem, because if you look at my table, if you look at the table, the soil erodibility, and again, this is information that's from all these tables in the soil survey that talk about the different characteristics of these.
And again, you're referring to exhibit, or your appellant's exhibit 5.
Yes. So again, my exhibit's not going to have the very last one, which is that Ragnar, the number 46. It has severe slope erosion hazard. So half of that footprint has been mapped by the NRCS as having severe slope erosion potential.
And was there any analysis done in any of DCD or ULIN's materials about what the implications of building a road on severe slope erosion soil might be?
They did discuss it for the Neilton and the District Zerothrent, I believe. The Kilchis soil series was not discussed as much as I thought it should have been, because that's been described as having runoff that is rapid and that hazard of a water erosion is severe. There's a shallow depth to rock. So anyway, the characteristics of the soils that were mentioned in both the engineering reports and the geotech report were ones that are more engineering oriented and less in terms of erosion hazard oriented. And obviously, every one of our fields has their own way of analyzing data. It's one of the reasons I like teams on projects, because you get lots of experts with different background and when we're discussing a project, we all learn stuff from each other. But when you're looking at the erosion hazard potential for and the Norma fine sandy loams, those are mostly associated with the wetlands in the area because that's a wetland soil. But when you all talk about these different things, you know, I as a soil scientist versus an engineer who knows soils from an engineering capacity, we would start talking about this and realize that I would have severe concerns about building a road on some of these soils, and they would be looking at it as, you know, what kind of base do we need to put down over this, and not what you're dealing or what kind of material you need to put over the base and how you need to prepare it. So I'm thinking of upstream and downstream issues, especially with the amount of water in this system, and that's why I'm concerned, because what, 1, 2, 3, 4 of these soils has high erosion capacity. And that's not good in when you're discussing roads. And, you know, again, I've been in these systems, I've watched them after massive blowouts, and it's kind of the same story over and over and over again. Well, we passed the watershed analysis module, you know, but the reality of what happens on the ground is that this is what happens in these kinds of soils. And these kinds of soils are what we find associated with a lot of our logging roads, because our forests tend to grow on glacial soils.
So if I'm understanding your objection correctly, and please correct me if I'm not, are you saying DCD and Ulan's materials analyzed these soils for purposes of seeing whether a road could be built on them, but failed to analyze them for what the impacts of erosion downstream might be?
Correct.
Okay. Do you have anything else to add with regard to, so, well, I suppose there is one other thing on soil erodibility. Can we go back to the second map, the zoomed-in map? This will be kind of an intersection of wetlands and soil erodibility here. Yeah, that's the one.
I'm sorry. I must have clicked it closed, everybody.
Well, we've all got the paper copy of the map, too. But it's upside down.
Okay. I am getting faster.
Talk to me about culverts. What are we looking at here in terms of culverts that would allow for drainage of these wetlands or passage of eroded soils?
Basically, two are proposed. I believe one is pre-existing, which is why, and it was permitted in 2016. Which is why it wasn't covered in the SDAP. So in flow coming from uphill, you have, and for some reason I don't understand why there's no topo shown uphill, but the water would pinch down, hit this culvert, and go under the road and come out into this drainage system, and then there is the second culvert that's further down right here. That same thing would happen. There's a pinch point where it would drain in from here and pass through under the road.
Physically speaking, there are three culverts through the road.
Yeah, there's one at the far end, too,
right,
which isn't even included.
And an HPA was granted for one of the culverts, right?
Yeah, this is a pre-existing, and it's literally within feet of the end of the project.
Right. But the other two don't have an HPA.
No, one of them does.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah.
Which one does?
I believe it's this one, but I can't say for sure because it was hard to follow. So, but one of them has an HPA issued on it.
Well,
supplement that it is the diagonal that has right. The HPA.
Okay. Well, we'll have your expert testify as to that, please. Is it your understanding that the reason there weren't HPAs for all three culverts is because there's not constant streams flowing through all three culverts?
The reason that that this one wasn't issued is that it's already established and it's outside the footprint of the new proposed project area. The reason that this one wasn't discussed is I believe that this is the one that was permitted in 2016, so they contend that that's already been dealt with. Although the footprint of the road is going to expand, but it's a pre-existing culvert and it's not going to be upgraded. So this is the only one that an HPA was issued for.
So we've got three culverts, and I'd like to set aside the issue of, you know, did they have HPAs? I realize we're not, you know, in front of the PCHB here. Do you think just physically in terms of handling discharge and soil erosion and so forth that there are sufficient culverts proposed for this road?
You know, it's very hard for me to say because the amount of information, I haven't been out again, and the amount of information that's in the reports is not reported in a way that I would be able to tell how much water comes through this. I assume that this topographic feature, which is like a little hill, continues to the north. So this looks like it's a pinch down point between two higher elevation areas. But I don't know how much water flows through that system and the timing of it, because there wasn't a discussion of, again, high volume storm events and back-to-back storm events.
If there had been a discussion of high volume storm events and back-to-back storm events, would you expect to see more discussion of where, you know, water overflows might go?
Yes.
And by overflows, I mean, you know, it's not normally flowing, but it's flowing now?
Yes.
Okay.
And I will tell you, I called the Department of Fish and Wildlife and that issued the HPA, and they were not concerned because when they were out, there was very little evidence of much flow at all in that area. So, you know, they weren't out during high-volume storm events or back-to-back storm events.
If they had been out during high-volume storm events and back-to-back storm events, would there tend to be more water than they observed?
Oh, there would be more water, but I have no way of knowing if it's a concern or not because it wasn't evaluated.
Do you have anything else to add on either wetlands or soil erodibility in terms of unexamined impacts? I have no further questions to ask.
Yeah, I'd have to look, but again, you have all my documentation where I went through everything.
Opportunity for cross?
We will. You mentioned during your overview of the whole project that you had some concerns regarding the modification of surface water flows. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, when you grade an area, you obviously modify the natural flow patterns. So, yes.
You'd mentioned that there was some kind of concern with the quarries themselves monitoring the surface water flows. That's what I'm asking about. What was that all about?
No, I'm not sure I said exactly that. What I said was when you quarry an area, you change both the surface flow patterns and the groundwater flow patterns. Because you're removing rock, you're typically lowering the groundwater in that area, or at least where it discharges to surface, you're changing the recharge pattern, the water recharge, which is the water infiltrating back into the earth. Patterns, and I mean, much can be said about any activity that alters the terrain. You're going to be compacting, you're going to be filling, so you're going to be changing groundwater and surface water patterns.
Okay. And was there any analysis done of the impact of those changes?
Yes, but again, not in a way that I saw was going to discuss potential impacts, either dewatering or adding to water in the wetland systems. And you know, with respect to the road, they did more identifying how the road should be constructed in order not to have water be an issue. But certainly from a perspective of maintaining pre-development hydrology to the wetlands and the streams, no, they did. It was not evaluated.
So what would you have liked to see in terms of an evaluation that would have been good?
Well, in an ideal world, I would have liked to have seen some groundwater monitoring wells and had them monitor for at least one, if not two, calendar years. But that the expectation that would be done is not there.
I was going to ask about groundwater and groundwater infiltration. Why did you say earlier that you thought groundwater infiltration might be an issue for this project?
The Department of Natural Resources for Washington State has mapped this entire footprint of this project as a recharge area.
Okay.
And I actually pulled that map and have blown up the area. So I can show that map to you. It's one of our exhibits.
Please do, and I'll talk everyone on to the exhibit.
So here's,
so this is exhibit A7.
Here's the Kitsap County critical aquifer recharge area category 1 and 2 map. And obviously this is not a helpful map. So I went to the footprint of the actual SDAP area and blew it up. And
just to be clear, sir, are you saying is all you did just zoomed in?
Yeah, all I did was zoom in on that PDF. So this is the county's own data. And I included the legend so you could see. There we go. So I'll zoom it back up. But the category ones are potential for certain land use activities to adversely affect groundwater is high, and category 2 provide recharge to aquifers that are currently or will become potable water supplies and are vulnerable to contamination based on the type of land use activity. So this is a category 2, and this is the outline of the project area. So this is in the aquifer mapped aquifer recharge area for the state.
And what analysis, if any, have you seen of the implications of changing the water flows and potentially impounding water by this road in an aquifer recharge area?
I have seen in 2 of all the documents that I read, a mention that it's in the aquifer recharge area, and I did not see any discussion on how to protect the aquifer recharge area, mitigate for impacts to the aquifer recharge area, or anything else like that.
What would be some consequences of failing to consider that, like real-world physical consequences?
Well, these are areas where surface precipitation infiltrates into the ground and refills the groundwater, and then therefore supplies the lakes, the streams, and the wetlands. When you impact the recharge area, then any of those receiving areas, the groundwater, the streams, the wetlands, and the lakes, could potentially be dewatered or overwatered, but that could be the impact. You could have a completely change the groundwater hydrology and flows of an area.
And what would that mean? Why is it bad to change the groundwater flows of an entire area?
Because the wetlands could go away, the streams won't receive their base flow. It can completely alter the physiological face of the area. It's just a really bad idea. And they are protected by state law, but it's not really considered in this project.
All right. I suppose I'll ask you to just summarize, based on the 4 topics you've mentioned of wetlands, soil erodibility, surface water flows and groundwater flows, and I guess mitigation, if we're counting that as an impact as well, what needs to be done to fix this project?
Well, all the inconsistencies and information that's lacking in the reports should be added, and proper mitigations for each of the potential impacts on those things should be required. And provided. So, you know, when I review these projects again, I don't come at it from a perspective of let's get those guys. I come at it from a perspective of what will make this project better. What information do I see that I could provide would end up in less overall impact, environmental impact from this project occurring? And I have identified the areas where I think there it was a failure to provide sufficient information and or if the information was provided to use it in the analysis of what conditions were going to be levied as a condition of approval from the county. And so I have identified, you know, and the project proponent went through my document and identified, I think, 25 different areas that they had responses to. I have provided the information that I think is salient. And, you know, simply responding back to my comments that we did what was required is really not going to make this project a better project. Simply requiring or fulfilling a superficial requirement is really not going to lessen the potential impacts of this road on the landscape in the area.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Okay.
Madam Examiner, if you have questions for her, please.
Not at this time, but thank you. Do you all want to move to Cross, or do you all need a short break to move cars, or?
We should probably move cars, and plus she's been testifying for an hour and a half.
Okay, yeah. So how much, I'd like to keep moving on this, but how much time would be?
Here, ma'am?
Yes.
There's been so many changes since we walked in this morning that down to these issues and the testimony we just heard, I would appreciate if we could have 45 minutes to an hour to work with experts and have them prepared because the focus was so much larger than it is now. Drill in and make sure they're focused on these issues that are important to address this afternoon. We weren't sure what the issues were reduced to.
Is there a response from the appellant?
Well, I mean, 45 minutes or an hour is a long time. Dr. Cook has already provided her report, and they have already had their experts respond to it. We haven't heard anything new today. They've seen all the exhibits. I mean, if their experts came unprepared to rebut the exhibits and Dr. Cook's report, they have only themselves to thank. I do think a break is in order, but not an hour of prep time. I mean, they've had weeks of prep time.
So, DCD have anything?
No,
okay. Well, it is, what time is it? About 12:30. So it would be the normal lunchtime. And there was some ambiguity on exactly the scope of the issue and so forth. So I'm inclined to go ahead and grant an hour so you all can both eat, move cars, as well as think through the scope of the issues and so forth. So let's reconvene at my clock right about 12:24, so probably about 1:30, almost 1, not just before 1:30.
No, almost.